Welcome to Inside the Guard on BloodyElbow.com. I am your host, TP Grant, and today we are talking about UFC 182. Well, overall, UFC 182 gave us a pretty solid show. I know there's been a lot of complaining about the quality of fights we got and the number of decisions that we got, but all in all, I actually enjoyed the night of fights that we ended up getting for the most part. I mean, obviously there were some pretty slow sections of that, and there's been a lot of complaints about the pacing of the event and how many commercials were thrown into this one, and I think there's some valid criticism to be made there, but that's not what we're here to talk about. This show today is going to be focused primarily on the light heavyweight title fight between Jon Jones and Daniel Cormier, much anticipated. Mostly because of the rivalry between the two men. They do not like each other. They still do not like each other. And they got in a cage to try to punch each other. So people were interested, to say the least. The traffic for this event has been off the charts in terms of online traffic. There's been a ton of interest. And just anecdotally, friends of mine who probably haven't watched an MMA event since Chris Weidman versus Anderson Silva 2 seem to be very, very jazzed up for this event. So overall, I think this event really hit that crossover mainstream sweet note for people and got a lot of people watching, which is partially why I think MMA fans are so appalled that the event was as average as it ended up being. So we're going to take a look at Jon Jones's game plan, and then we're going to go into the MMA level up, and we're going to close out today's show talking omoplatas and focusing on Donald Cerrone's near omoplata of Miles Jury. So let's get into it. If you're noticing an uptick in the audio quality of this show and find yourself strangely attracted to the sound of my voice, do not adjust your listening device of choice. It's simply due to the fact that I actually have real audio equipment now for the show. So, moving on to the fights, the real thing here about Jon Jones' game plan for Daniel Cormier was he wanted to grind Cormier down. It was pretty clear that he wanted to make a late round assault on Daniel Cormier after he had spent the first three rounds really wearing down Daniel. And the way it ended up working was Jones ended up using a really persistent, dedicated body attack on Daniel Cormier that really stole his cardio from him in the later rounds. And that really showed itself when Jones started being able to take Cormier down. I don't think it was obviously it's a sign of Jon Jones being an outstanding wrestler that fresh Daniel Cormier was not able to take Jones down, and they were able to battle in the clinch as long and as deeply technical manner as they did. But those late takedowns were largely seemed to be due to the fact that Daniel Cormier was out of gas at that point. And it was really the body attack that resulted in that Daniel Cormier losing his ability to fight. Now, in terms of pure numbers, Jones, I believe, threw something close to the number of body shots that he threw here against Glover Teixeira. But in terms of proportional offense, percentage of offense directed towards the body from Jones' overall offense in the fight, this is by far the highest percentage he's ever thrown to the body. He threw 36% of his strikes to the body. Meanwhile, Daniel Cormier was largely headhunting and threw nearly 70% of his strikes to Jones' head, which was highly effective at times. I'm not criticizing Daniel Cormier too heavily here. He was going to work on Jones in the clinch with uppercuts and coming with overhand rights, but Jones was clearly playing the long game and really planning on winning those later rounds. Also, what really stands out is almost half of Jon Jones' offense, nearly 50%, it actually came in at 43%, was landed in the clinch. Compare that to his fights with Glover Teixeira, where only about 18% of his offense was directed towards the body, and then less than 30% of it came inside the clinch. Compare that to even later striking battles that Jon Jones got into, such as the Alexander Gustafsson fight, where only 20% of his offense was directed towards the body, nearly 40% of it directed towards the leg and the heads, and then only 5% of his offense came from the clinch. He was fighting almost exclusively at distance. Or we go all the way back to the Rashad Evans fight, where you see that 81% of Jon Jones' offense came from distance striking, and only less than 20% of it, 17%, came in the clinch, and then only 18% of that overall offense was directed towards the body of Rashad Evans. I think it's pretty clear from those numbers, all of which are coming off of fightmetric.com, that Jones's game is in flux. He is shifting his game, which is why we're making John Jones our MMA level up of this show. For those of you who missed the first edition of MMA Level Up, it is a section of the show in which we take a look at a fighter who is growing their skill set or changing how they fight in some way, and makes reference to the idea of leveling up in a video game. And if this somehow offends you because you don't actually level up in real life like you do in video games, relax, it's just a show. So, looking at John Jones right now, one of the things that really stood out is how he wrestled with Daniel Cormier. Now, this doesn't seem like a huge leap because John Jones, we know, has been a fantastic MMA wrestler from the get-go. He's really always been on that cutting edge. And we saw him utilize some of his old tricks now, but at the time they were really kind of revolutionary, such as his throwing a punch and reaching down for a knee pick at the same time, essentially doing a wrestling like knee or ankle pick. But instead of doing when it's taught to you in most grappling sports, they tell you to think like you're throwing a punch when you're trying to off balance somebody to sweep up a knee or a leg, and John Jones simply replaced it with the fact of throwing an actual punch. He busted out that trick against Daniel Cormier a couple of times. Didn't actually get Cormier down with it at any point. But what he really showed off was really outstanding defensive wrestling, something that lapsed against Alexander Gustafsson, and where a lot of people thought Daniel Cormier would really have an advantage on John Jones because of his Olympic background. A lot of people were predicting Daniel Cormier to really just ragdoll John Jones around. So let's take a look first at what Daniel Cormier did to get John Jones up in the fifth round and get him off the ground and actually get something close to approximating a takedown. And then we'll look at how Jones stopped that. Now, Cormier got a lift from the high crotch in the fifth round. And it's one of his favorite takedowns. He used it exceedingly well against Josh Barnett in their fight. Now, for those of you watching the video, I'm putting up a picture of Daniel Cormier's lift taken by Jane Kamin-Wansia of USA Today Sports, which she shared with Bloody Elbow. And you can see that Daniel Cormier has John Jones well off the mat at this point. And we're going to talk about the basics of a lifting takedown. And really, you need to off-balance your opponent, clearly, for any takedown. And usually that's accomplished either you can pull or push them off-balance, something referred to in judo as the kizushi, or you can take an angle on them and then find yourself it makes it much more effective way to take people off-balance when you don't have a gi on or something to really pull or push on. So angle is something that you look for. When you're seeking a takedown, dominant grips, and in this case, you can see that Daniel Cormier has his hands connected around John Jones' legs, very, very close to his hips, and hip placement is very, very important, and you can see that John Jones' hips are almost directly underneath Daniel Cormier's hips. He's arching his back to drive his hips inward to give himself more lift on John Jones, making him easier to pick up. So the idea of grip fighting, getting dominant grips when seeking a takedown, angling, finding that dominant angle, and where your hips are all really key aspects to how to stop a takedown. Now, what John Jones ended up doing to stop this from happening for almost the entirety of the fight was he was winning the grip fight and the angle fight, which in that case meant that Daniel Cormier could not get into any meaningful position to throw him. Now, this is much, much bigger and more complicated than just the simple idea that gets tossed out there by commentators a lot of times, and the idea that you just stop someone from getting an underhook on you and you're winning a no-gi grip battle. So let's, for a second, talk about the idealized situation of clinching with someone. The idealized situation of clinching with someone is that you are on an angle in which you can drive into them and force them to move sideways while you're moving forward. That's the idea of taking an angle. It's very similar to an angle in boxing or striking, in which the person is looking directly ahead and not seeing you, and you are looking in and kind of seeing the side of their face. Ideally, also, I would have both my hands on them, and they would have neither of their hands on me. I would have two grips, and they would have no grips. I would have an angle, and I would have my hips in and underneath theirs. From there, I'm in a pretty ideal position to do whatever the heck I want in a takedown game. Now, obviously, you're never going to really get all three without a fight that ideally. Most of the time in a live match, you settle yourself with having two out of the three to get a takedown. And John Jones knew that Daniel Cormier likes to get that high crotch lift, and that really, if I don't have two grips, I'm going to have a really hard time getting an angle, and I'm going to have a really hard time getting my hips in position to throw somebody. So John Jones spent a lot of time getting wrist control on Cormier and focusing on keeping one of Cormier's hands, or in some cases, both of Cormier's hands, out of the action. And he was doing that by getting nice tight wrist control and forcing Cormier's hands down to around his waist level. And from there, Cormier really couldn't connect his hands. And if you can't grab someone, you're going to have a very hard time wrestling with them. Now, this is a credit to John Jones, because John Jones just has to be massively strong to be able to control someone like Daniel Cormier, who's been wrestling since he could walk. To control his wrists like that is an incredibly difficult feat. And John Jones was doing it consistently. And from that position, John Jones was also winning the head battle. Now, head fighting is just as important part of kind of wrestling as hand fighting. And Jones was consistently getting his forehead into the side of Daniel Cormier's jaw, making it very difficult for Cormier to turn to face him, and actually placing John Jones on that angle that he wanted. So he was spending a lot of the fight with two out of the three requirements to really toss someone. He had dominant grips. He was consistently going two-on-one on Daniel Cormier and forcing Daniel Cormier to only fight with one grip. And he had an angle for good portions, and Cormier had to address both of those things before he could really start going to work on Jones. So that right there, some basic fundamental wrestling, is really what stopped Daniel Cormier. And Jones really kind of threw in his own little twist, because anytime Daniel Cormier started getting in on his body and got an underhook, Jones would immediately get his hips away, and then he would go for that shoulder wrench that he did on Glover Teixeira. And I did a judo chop on it, so if you want more details on that particular shoulder lock, there is a judo chop on it. Go Google it. Type in bloody elbow, judo chop, John Jones, Glover Teixeira, and it should come up. And it is a technique that is quite literally as old as the hills, and existed in medieval texts on fighting. It is an incredibly old technique, and it made Daniel Cormier really think twice about taking an underhook on John Jones, which would have been very helpful. It is obviously one of the better controlling grips you can get. So you had Jones kind of really winning this grip fight, winning this, preventing Daniel Cormier from getting into the ideal positions for him to get his takedowns. Now, what we're going to do is, I'm very excited to do this, we're going to bring in a special guest here to talk a little bit about how striking integrated in with this wrestling to really form Jones' complete game plan and really contribute to his thoroughly beating Daniel Cormier in the later rounds. And joining me now is Lucas Buldun, a moderator for Bloody Elbow, and also, I believe, a writer for Undercard Superstar, correct?
Yeah, it's been a while since I wrote anything with Glory being... I write mostly about kickboxing, and since Glory hasn't been doing so well, and the whole gap between the events, I haven't written so much lately.
Yeah, but when you did, you were a technical writer for them, weren't you?
I used to do kickboxing classics and old fights. Like I think I did the second Rob Kaman versus Ernesto Hoost fight, stuff like that. And I used to do breakdowns for Glory events.
What's your background in martial arts, real quick, before we get started?
I started when I was about 15 with jiu-jitsu, but not Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu fighting system is kind of the complete martial arts for judo. You can do a bit of striking, a lot of judo, and a bit more groundwork than regular judo. And then I did that for about 7 years, and I've done some Kyokushin karate too, and now I'm just doing Muay Thai.
Excellent. So, it was noted on the broadcast that Jones was making pretty extensive use of southpaw, and I've already spoken about how the body attack was really a key portion of Jones' success over Daniel Cormier. How does his using the southpaw stance really play into a body attack?
Well, when you use an open guard in striking, an orthodox fighter versus a southpaw fighter, it really opens the right side of the orthodox fighter is really open to the rear leg of the southpaw striker. So generally, the easiest kick to land in that configuration is a left middle kick to the liver. For both fighters, their rear middle kick is the strike that's gonna land the most. But the advantage the southpaw fighter has is his left middle kick is gonna land on the side of the liver.
Could you quickly describe for the listeners and viewers who haven't been hit with a liver shot before, what does it feel like to get cracked in the liver?
It's like it basically shuts down your body. Even not a hard shot will make you like take a step back, fold in two, and fall over. It's really like being knocked out, but you're awake for it.
I've not had the pleasure of getting cracked in the liver yet.
Lucky you.
I've done a little bit of striking, but I've never eaten a really good liver shot, and I'm thankful that I haven't experienced that yet.
Yeah, it's really the worst. And even not the hard ones that will make you fall, knock you down. Even just a light strike will gas you. It's like you've done a round more than you've already done.
Yeah, and
Does that make sense?
Yes, and I think we saw that take place for Daniel Cormier, who slowed down noticeably in the later rounds after a pretty persistent body attack from Jones.
Yeah, I think Jones landed in the first two rounds. I think he landed like a really good straight left to the body, and a couple of some good middle kicks. And I remember a knee in the clinch in the second round, like he. He gets just a little bit of separation, and with his length, the knee strike goes just straight to Cormier's liver, and that one I think I remember the most.
Speaking of this fight, I've already talked a bit about how Jones's grip fighting really played into shutting down Cormier's takedowns. But we talked a little bit about Twitter. Would you care to talk about how did his grip fighting play into his clinch striking game, which really took off in this fight?
Yeah, once again, he kept fighting clinching southpaw. So once again, his rear leg side is right in line with the liver of Cormier for the knees. And then fighting, what he did is he took they were mostly fighting in the first two rounds about who gets on the inside with the collar tie. And wrist control on the other side. And what Jones did, it was that he would bring Cormier's right hand and pin it to his belt line. And with the length he has, he can still just flick his elbow over and get an elbow to the head.
Very similar to what he does inside the guard with guy on him.
Yeah, he really does the same thing like what he did to Brandon Vera.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. It was the left side too.
It's very reminiscent of how he plays elbows on the ground. In the clinch, did you see anything that Daniel Cormier, he was really landing uppercuts for a while
In the first two rounds, I think, like I told you on Twitter, I think the second round, which Cormier won, in my opinion, I think it's the best round of clinching I've ever seen in mixed martial arts.
Yeah, it was pretty fantastic.
It was really, the grip fighting. I think for this one, they were mostly fighting on who gets the inside position with the collar tie to be able to bring the head of the other down or bring it to the side in the elbows. And what Cormier did was, when he managed to back Jones up a bit, he would get on the inside and then he could pull Jones said into the pocket. I think he really landed some really nice ones towards the end of the second when he buckled Jones' knees.
He filled that space when Jones was separating their hips and really trying to get away from that potential body lock from Cormier. I felt Cormier at times filled that space very well with knees, but he got away from
it with knees. And I think I remember also on a clinch exit, he went with the right middle kick to Jones, who was really close to the cage. They almost backed him up into the cage, the force of the kick. I think that was a really, really nice one on the exit.
Yeah. So I think it's pretty clear that John Jones' clinch striking game, it jumped in this fight. It went to another level. There was a time when he really didn't seem... He came into MMA as this amazing clinch wrestler, and then he started kind of working outside striking, and now we've kind of seen it come back full circle to where he's dominating in the clinch. And this is a pretty common thing you see with wrestlers adding striking to their game. They start on the outside and then work their way in. How do you, and personally... Do you feel that was the best way for Jones to go, considering his...
No, I don't think so. Even early in his career, he had good success with the clinch striking. It wasn't as polished as he's just murdering people with elbows. But even like when he took the title from Shogun, most of the striking he did in that fight, I think that was like one of his first two fights with Greg Jackson and Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, I think it was his second fight with them.
Yeah. And really, all the best striking job he did, even the finishing combo with the left hook to the body to knee, most of it was inside striking. It's only after that, like around the Rampage fight, that you really started to just sit back and play distance striking, bring the chasseba to the knees, the side kicks. I don't really think that was the best way, the most efficient way to build a fighter like John Jones. With the style of wrestling he has, and the body type he has, because in Muay Thai, the clincher's body type is really tall and lanky, because having that length, when you have the reach advantage, the length in the clinch, things just become so much easier. You don't have... go ahead.
I was going to say, I think a prime example of somebody kind of building themselves in the correct order, I feel like Ronda Rousey really has, where against she's kind of started building her striking game from the clinch and has been building it outwards. Because I agree with you. We saw, I think, the Rampage and the Evans fight were two fights in which we saw John Jones really content to just play the outside striker. Against Evans, it kind of made sense. Because the word was is that Evans used to kind of beat him up
on the ground a little bit. Yeah, on the ground, beat him up wrestling.
So you were saying in the clinch. So how is John Jones leveraging his length inside the clinch? Where I think a lot of people assume the shorter, stockier fighter has the advantage.
I mean the length. I think it was like the clear example was in the Cormier fight. How hard the time Cormier had to get in on Jones on the clinch because of how he used his collar tie with the elbow right on the collarbone, which it allows him to just keep the distance between him and Cormier, where he can strike and Cormier can't. It just makes him so much easier for him because he doesn't have... Since the clinch takes place so much at this distance of clinching,
I think the way he's also blended it together with his wrestling.
Yeah.
Fits really perfectly, because anytime you're now, it's whenever you're trying to create space to get your hips away from him and try to get away from his takedown game, he's able to fill.
You hit a strike.
Yeah. And if you're trying to close in and the way Daniel Cormier was and try to take away that space, he's able to really get those elbows into you and create space and then bring the elbow strikes and bring the knees.
And the striking opens up further opportunities and takedowns. Yeah, and that was the way too. And that's the great thing about Ronda Rousey's clinch game. Is that she blends? She's starting to blend in, like the combo she did to finish Alexis Davis, where she goes for the right hand, then the knee, which brings her. Basically, it provides her with the balancing of Davis that she needs to throw.
Yeah, that was a fantastic example of blending striking and grappling, and something that you really only see in something like MMA, or actually we actually drilled that exact sequence in a combat sambo class that I take, and it was punch your way in, you know, grab the guy's kirka or his jacket, throw a knee, and then right into whatever hip throw you want to go to.
That was one of my favorite things to do, because I started jiu-jitsu fighting system, so pretty much judo with a bit of striking and a bit more groundwork. When I started, I was 15, and that's pretty late of an age in France to start judo. Most of the guys I train with, they've been on a tatami since they were like six. So, and judo, I'm just not really particularly good at it. So, what do you do in jiu-jitsu where you're allowed to strike in the clinch? Basically, the exact same thing Ronda did. I do left knee to araigoshi or hip throw. That was really the thing. Because in a gi, I'm not really sure how... it doesn't really make sense to my body in the way Muay Thai does, where I have a much easier time clinching. I don't have to think all the time about how I'm going to off-balance an opponent to throw him. And having the opportunity to strike, to provide that off balancing without having to do it in a judo way, allows me to throw guys that I would never have thrown in a judo context.
Yeah. All right. Fantastic. Hey, thank you very much for jumping in. Hope to have you back sometime.
Yeah, awesome. My pleasure.
So again, special thanks to Lucas for coming on here. I'm not going to attempt to say your last name without you here to correct me on it again, who joined us via Skype. I recorded that beforehand, so my audio obviously dropped off a little bit in terms of volume, so sorry about that, but fantastic interview, interesting stuff, really, really sharp guy, Lucas, and I hope to have him back again to talk about striking at some other point, as well. I understand striking conceptually. I don't have the experience in that particular realm of martial arts that I do in grappling, and I defer to people wiser than I when it comes to that context of the sport. Speaking of grappling, there was a fantastic bit of grappling in the co-main event. I don't know why the UFC tags every second to last fight as the co-main event. Really, the second to last fight in Donald Cerrone, I should say, and Miles Jury featured a fantastic little piece of grappling by Donald Cerrone, who slapped on an omoplata lightning quick on Miles Jury. And we're going to take a look at exactly how that happened with our in-depth look of the omoplata. So the basics of the omoplata are, it is a shoulder lock submission in which the person, the submitter, uses their legs to basically accomplish what a kimura does in forcing your arm to go behind your back and up towards your head while actually coming away from your body doing that. So basically, if you put your hand behind your back, like you put your fist, your knuckles against your spine, and bring your arm up and away from your body, you should start feeling some pressure on your shoulder. You yourself can actually put a fair amount of pressure on your shoulder just doing that if you're inflexible like me. And basically, an omoplata accomplishes that using your legs on the other person's arm. It's not a hard position to get into in grappling, but it is a devilishly tricky submission to finish, which is why you don't see a lot of people doing it. So we're going to take a look at how exactly Donald Cerrone got into it, because it was a really clever piece of grappling. And it was basically off when Miles Jury caught a kick and then took Donald Cerrone to the mat, basically doing a knee pick takedown off of a caught kick. He threw his right arm over Donald Cerrone's shoulder, forcing him backwards and turning him over that leg that he caught. So the only real limb that could stop Donald Cerrone from falling was the his right leg, which he had thrown a kick with and was currently caught up in Miles Jury's grasp, so he fell to the ground. And this transition of standing to ground is a really interesting one, and it, because there are so many forces acting at once, and usually there's a fair amount of momentum, and you have guys landing in positions they would never put themselves in kind of like step-by-step grappling encounters. And in this case, Miles Jury's right hand lands on the mat as he's falling forward into his takedown, because he had to kind of throw himself into the takedown to get Donald Cerrone down on the mat. And Cerrone really didn't fight this takedown much. He anticipated the takedown. He knew he had lost the battle, so he didn't waste a lot of time or energy fighting it. Rather, he went to the ground rather easily, knowing that there could be an instance or an opening when they hit the ground. And the moment they hit the ground, he noticed that Miles Jury's hand was on the mat. He grabbed the wrist and attempted to go for a triangle. Anytime you put your hand on the mat inside the guard, it's usually considered a pretty big mistake in jiu-jitsu circles, and you leave yourself open to kimuras, omoplatas, and triangles. And Donald Cerrone has an excellent triangle. He attempted to push Miles Jury's right hand away from him and sneak his left leg out to throw up a triangle. And Miles Jury responded correctly to this by posturing up. But Miles Jury's left arm was still wrapped around Donald Cerrone's right leg from the takedown, which is out of position, because Donald Cerrone's next option is to then go for the omoplata, which he did, and he did it quite well. He very, very quickly got parallel with Miles Jury and got his arm across the waist of Miles Jury. And the pictures you're seeing now, the lower quality images are screen captures, and the higher quality ones are from the incomparable Esther Lynn of MMAfighting.com. And as you can see, her pictures have a pretty excellent shot of Cerrone with his arm around Miles Jury's waist, and Miles Jury attempting to posture out of the omoplata. The arm over the waist stops Miles Jury doing the forward roll escape, in which you roll over the shoulder that is trapped in the omoplata, and you roll yourself out of the shoulder lock. You roll with the rotation, or the force being put on your arm, taking the pressure off of your arm, and you usually can roll and end up either back in the person's guard or pass directly into side control. So Donald Cerrone's arm around the hip stops that. So Miles Jury is then doing the second escape, in which he sits up, and he's actually taking Donald Cerrone completely off the mat here. And Cerrone is doing something which is commonly referred to in jiu-jitsu circles, both commonly and comically, as clarking. Referring to Clark Gracie, who is an omoplata player in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu tournaments. Clark actually achieved a fair level of fame for the picture that I have up now by John LaMonica, in which he has snapped a picture of Clark in pretty much this position being lifted off the mat. And this was during the ridiculously photogenic meme boom, and Clark Gracie actually got taken on the Today Show and got quite a bit of press for this picture. And Clark ends up in this position a lot because he prefers the omoplata. It is his submission. He specializes in this submission. And I've actually done a couple seminars with Clark, and I've rolled with Clark on two or three occasions. And I ended up in omoplatas in all of them. And actually, one of the catches he used was very similar to the one that Miles Jury was caught in which he used his butterfly guard to elevate me off the mat, and I posted to stop the sweep, and as soon as I posted, I found myself in an omoplata. And really, what I learned from those experiences is what we saw here with Cerrone. The omoplata is an easy position to get into, is a very difficult submission to finish. Now, given when Clark was rolling with me, he was not going all out. I'm a thoroughly average purple belt at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I've been training about 5 to 6 years. I'm really nothing special. And Clark wasn't going particularly hard, but I was able to survive inside of Clark's omoplata for a good minute and a half to 2 minutes each time he puts me in it and attempt several escapes. it's really a position you have to wear your opponent down in, as they can be very strong in this position, especially guys like a Miles Jury, who's posturing up as hard as he can. You're not going to get a quick tap with the submission. You really have to break someone down and break them forward. And really, every time Clark's put me in an omoplata, it's been a battle of inches as my arm comes out slowly and slowly gets further behind my back, and I'm able to posture up less and less in that position. And Cerrone did a very, very nice job of kind of breaking Jury down. And then he finally got to this position, which Estra Lynn captured, and Cerrone very nearly had the submission here. This is very, very close, and really what saved Jury here was the fact that it was no gi, and he had some slipperiness to slide out of that position, because had this been a gi match or any other sort of grappling competition, it's highly likely that he would not have been able to slide his arm out, and it would have been finished here. And Cerrone used it as a sweep, which is what most jiu-jitsu players and grapplers do with this submission, the omoplata. They will catch the omoplata and really use it mostly as a sweep, because a lot of people don't have the patience and the counter game that Clark Gracie has to stop people from escaping from it. So they'll hold on to it and then allow the person to escape and use their escape as a sweep to take more dominant position, which is exactly what Donald Cerrone did, and frankly something a lot more MMA fighters could do with the position, but a lot of fighters don't invest time with this because it's frankly kind of a low percentage submission. Something else that Clark does when he ends up in omoplatas, when the opponent's on all fours, that he has shown to us in seminars, is he will, most people are taught to scoot away from the person. For instance, in this position, Cerrone could scoot his hip out from Miles Jury and attempt to finish the omoplata. Clark actually scoops out and around in a circular motion, trying to go around behind the hips of the person in the omoplata, kind of trying to get behind them, and he does it rather violently, and it kind of forces you into this position that Cerrone has Jury in, but with the elbow deeper in, and it's frankly kind of a violent movement that is really quite nasty, and you end up in a deep omoplata, and it gets a pretty quick tap out of people. So this was a really nifty piece of grappling for Cerrone, because he stopped the rollout escape. He knew that that was Jury's go-to. He fought off the posturing and broke Jury back down, and kind of a battle of attrition there, in which kicking your legs forward is pretty much how Donald Cerrone did it, and that's kind of the standard way to fight the posture in an omoplata, is to just continually kick their legs forward, break them forward, and then he really had Miles Jury in a nearly checkmate position, and there was just enough room for Jury to sneak his elbow out and escape out of it, and then Cerrone, I mean, he ended up losing that particular battle, but he ended up winning the overall exchange and winning the round because he used it to take a more dominant position. So it was a really fantastic piece of transitional grappling that really all started off of Donald Cerrone giving up the battle on a takedown and attempting to win the next transition. So fantastic piece of transitional grappling, really nice technique from Cerrone on using the omoplata to get to a better position. So that was a really fun little piece of grappling. And that's going to wrap it up for Inside the Guard. We will be back for UFC Fight Night, McGregor versus Seaver. Until then, have a fantastic time and enjoy MMA.